5. Janet, can you give us a summary of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3305 would provide limited emergency unemployment benefits to persons who have exhausted their regular benefits, would apply to persons who exhausted their benefits on or after December 1st last year, and would extend such benefits for up to 6.5 weeks during the four-month period from April 3rd to July 30th this year. There is an emergency clause on the bill. You have at your place a hand and gross copy of the bill, or excuse me, that was routed yesterday, and today there is a fiscal impact statement and a dash one amendment that would delay the effective date due to the lead time that's needed to for the employment department to administer the extension, so that date becomes May 1st. Mr. Chair, that is all I have. I just wanted to point out to people, because it was confusing to me, that you don't see 6.5 weeks anywhere in the bill, but on line 25, that 25% of the individual's most recent regular unemployment benefit claim is where the number of weeks comes in, because a regular claim is 26 weeks.
So that'd equate to how many weeks?
It's my understanding that it's 6.5.
And
there are representatives from the department that can
we'll speak to that. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Representative Nelson, Representative Cameron, and Representative Dowland, please?
Cameron, do you need me down there? You need me?
Pardon?
You need me? You okay?
We always need you.
Oh, wrong.
Jeez. Yes. Make my day.
Hey, good morning, representatives.
Giddy up.
Was that on camera?
No, Captain Kate. The rule says do not move.
But I don't.
Good representatives, there is some standards we have.
You've all had the training to knock it off.
Chair Brown and distinguished committee members, thank you for your consideration today of House Bill 3305. Despite recent improvements in our state's economy, Oregon still has the fifth highest unemployment of the nation. Nearly 140,000 Oregonians are unemployed.
Unemployable.
Less than half remain eligible for unemployment benefits. Each week, almost 900 more Oregonians exhaust their unemployment benefits. Compounding this problem is the return of hundreds of members of the Oregon National Guard from service in Iraq and Afghanistan. Nearly half of our service members return home from the dangers of roadside bombs, mortar and machine gun fire, heat stroke and disease, only to find themselves facing yet another crisis, unemployment. We owe them a better welcome. House Bill 3305 gives an important boost to that safety net for Oregon's unemployment benefits. This bill will provide an extension of unemployment benefits at a time when needed benefits are running out. An extension of benefits isn't just a handout. It gives our workers a second chance. Oregon workers want good jobs so they can provide for their families and contribute to our economy. We have an obligation to support them in this effort. Furthermore, the time to act is now. As Mother Teresa would say, that's all we ever need to know. The time is now. It is crucial that House Bill 3305 is made into law as quickly as possible. The economy is growing, it is true. More and better jobs are on the horizon, but Oregonians need to pay rent now, need food on the table now. Shouldn't we provide this short-term benefit now? Providing this benefit extension to our unemployed workers as soon as possible will help keep families afloat now so they can build a better Oregon tomorrow. Chair Brown, distinguished members, we simply can't wait. I urge you to support House Bill 3305 and pass it on to the full House of Representatives. We owe it to Oregon. We most especially owe it to Oregonians and our returning troops. In our Veterans Committee, we talk about the term deployment to employment. Last night, if you had been at the event honoring the 162nd Infantry, who's just returned after 18 months in Iraq, you would have seen this incredible number of soldiers standing there for an hour and a half as the ceremonies were conducted. 40% of those are not going from deployment to employment. We have asked the senators and the representatives to contact the Chambers of Commerce, to contact all the businesses in their districts, to ask for assistance in finding jobs for these brave, brave men and women. Excuse me, these are brave men. There were no women other than one who was in public affairs. This is an infantry. Also, the good representative comp is working on a program that's called Troops to Teachers. But, you know, this legislature does not move quickly. Had it moved quickly, this bill would have been the first one heard in this session. Unfortunately, because of the delay of finding out if we could come up with the money and the procedures could be in place to activate additional 6.5 weeks of unemployment compensation, we now find ourselves closer to May 1st and that enactment. However, I want to tell you that I appreciate the Department of Employment. They tell me this day that if we'll expedite this bill, bring it to the House floor on Monday, over to the Senate, and by Tuesday, if the governor will sign it, we could have benefits in 2 weeks. Let me tell you this. In 1978, I was a single mother, three small children, and I destroyed my right leg. I had no job, no insurance, no home, no car. And let me tell you, I can empathize with those who are in this position. It wasn't a circumstance I wanted to be in. I had a master's degree. However, I was just transiting from Texas and returning to Oregon. Those things happen. It isn't fun. It's not something we love to do, to go to the employment agency and make those calls every week and say, yes, I've looked for a job, but haven't found one. I just want to say thank God. A businessman in my community came to my hospital bed, and I had cast up to my waist and said, if you'll come back to our company, which happened to be Evergreen International Aviation, Donna, you can start Evergreen Lifeline, the medevac company that I had previously worked to or campaigned for hospital-based programs. Many of our people, and I was told yesterday by the employment agency, there are 8,000 that may not be as lucky as Donna Nelson and her children were way back in 1978. Please assist us now. Today I even felt guilty in picking up my paycheck as I left the House of Representatives. Keep praying I'll win the lottery because I could help so many people. But until that happens, please help us activate the unemployment compensation for this next 6.5 week period.
Thank you, Representative.
Briefly say something.
Certainly, Representative Schlosser.
Thank you. Thank you for coming, Representative, all of you good representatives. But one thing I wanted to add to your list of Chamber of Commerce and business and the Employment Department, there's a bunch of nice union halls these men and women can go get a good family wage job, get start an apprenticeship, good trade. So I would add that to our list of places where these folks need to go.
Thank you very much, Chair Brown, Chair Schaffler, or Representative Schaffler. If you would, if you have contacts and you would ask those individuals to call my office so I have the numbers, I'm happy to pass that on and thank
you. Very good. Thank you.
Representative Dowlam.
Yes, thank you very, very much, Chair Brown, for the opportunity to give testimony in such a timely fashion. I want to tell you a poignant story from the campaign trail. First, there was three things that I campaigned on all across House District 59. Jobs, jobs, and jobs. In fact, on the Economic Development Committee, we're searching frantically for ways that we can start the pump. And we had testimony from a state economist that told us that in order to start the pump, we have to first get manufacturing going, and then we have to get technology going. And my concern was House District 59. I'm concerned because we don't have manufacturing and we don't have technology. And the analogy used was that in Oregon, we have to, it's like cars moving through a stoplight. We have to get the first few through, and then we'll get a few more through, and then we'll get a few more through. Now I want to tell you the story that took place in John Day, Oregon, while I was on the campaign trail. I was working in a manufactured home park, trailer park, pre-60 models, and I came upon a man on the steps, 1 foot up on the railing. And he said to me, young man, which was delightful in and of itself, and I wanted to stay there all day. But he said, if you come to campaign, the most important thing to me is a job. I really don't want an extension of unemployment benefits, but if that's the best you can do, be sure you do that. In Grant County, we lead the state in unemployment. We have double-digit stubborn unemployment that will not get down into the single-digit area. When we look at the percentage of the county that is unemployed and the number of unemployed in the city of John Day, this bill becomes not something we should do, but something that we urgently have to do. And I'm going to ask you to pass this out of committee onto the House floor. We will have an opportunity to send it to the Senate, and I hope that we can do breakneck speed. I have people in John Day that need this bill badly. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Cameron, please.
Thank you, Chair Brown, and members of the committee. My name is Kevin Cameron, House District 19 here in Salem, Marion County. And I come to testify to you today not only as a legislator, but as a citizen and as a business person and an employer in the state of Oregon, employing over 100 employees in our business. And in the last probably 3 to 4 years in our business climate environment throughout the whole state of Oregon, we have continued to do everything possible to remain productive and give good customer service and good value in our businesses. But through that, because of the business climate in the state and the pressures of commodities and wages, have had to continue to find ways to improve productivity and reduce hours available to our employees on our schedules. And that is just a known fact of a business person, and otherwise we won't be here unless we do the things to survive. And it's hard sometimes when we have to look at an employee and say, due to climate, we just don't have a job for you. Yet that's some of those tough decisions that we have to make. So with a heavy heart when we do that in our business, I also understand that there are other opportunities for us to continue to grow the business climate in the state of Oregon. This is just one thing we're talking about here, and there's a lot of other things that we could do to improve jobs, the opportunity for jobs, as other representatives have talked about. In Marion County today, the unemployment rate is at 7.9%. It is down from 8.7% a year ago. Those are the figures that were published by WorkSource Oregon that were just released this week. There is another reason why I feel this is something important. As an employer and as employees have worked in the state of Oregon, they've paid into this trust fund. I think this is one of the good models in our government system that we've been very smart about in saying, let's put money away for the days when we can't actually generate the revenue, or we need to tap into that revenue for situations that will be good business decisions for the state of Oregon, that would make an investment. The government can make an investment to keep balance in our system. And at this time, I think that's a really good business decision for us to dip into that trust fund to extend these benefits to people who are currently looking for work, and hopefully with seasonal and some of the improvements that we're seeing in our economy, we'll be on the front end of some more of those swings and be put back in the workforce here in the near future. So with that, I encourage you to support House Bill 3305.
Thank you, Representatives. The revenue impact for 2003-05 would be $19,844,000, just shy of $20 million. And our ability to be able to do that speaks well to how well we've managed the unemployment insurance in the state of Oregon. Okay. Through the last recession, twice we increased benefits for the unemployed. And just recently, out of this committee, the good Representative Schaffer had a bill that we have sent to the will send to the floor right today. Has it went out?
Yes.
Yeah, it's already went out. That will lower the income tax on the recipients of unemployment will pay at the lower level. The lower level people will, so it'll put more money in their pocket, and these people are certainly the ones that need it. This is, and I commend you, Representative Nelson, for bringing the bill forward. It's something that we should have moved on before, but we're going to get the job done now. Thank you. Representative Kitts.
Representative Nelson, I would just say that if you're truly feeling guilty about that paycheck, if you want to give it to me, I'm more than happy to take it.
Chair Brown, Representative Kitts, I am working on finding you a rich wife.
There you go. Good one.
And a young one. I'm a little too old.
Yeah.
But I appreciate that.
Well, thank you for your words of wisdom, Representative Nelson. Good job. Anything else? Any questions? Representative Boquist, welcome.
I bring nothing to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Distinguished members of the committee, for the record, I am Brian Boquist. I'm the state representative from the 23rd House District. That's five rural western Willamette Valley counties, none of which are economically well-to-do. All of them are forestry and timber-based, and all of them continue to struggle with unemployment problems. Furthermore, I'm in my 30th year as a reserve officer in the United States military. I'm hoping to retire finally after trying to for about 4 or 5 years. For the record, I served as the deputy commander of special operations in Iraq. My legislative assistant, Rachel Crawford, served as a team chief for 9 months in Afghanistan. And so we understand the impact on veterans these unemployment bills have. I, of course, am here to testify for House Bill 3305. The governor was kind enough on Tuesday to highlight the unemployment issues that we face in the state. He used some of my fellow veterans as an emphasis point to prove that we have a problem that we need to get up and move faster on. At that point, he had put pressure forward to utilize Senate Bill 7 and not this bill as the means of advancing those unemployment benefits rapidly. As of this morning, according to the Senate of the Clerk, Mr. Vice Chair, that is Senate Bill 7. It has not been introduced. It is still in legislative council on the good chamber to your rear. I think I'm geographic to your rear at this time, which leaves us in the position that House Bill 3305 is the fastest means that we can use to extend benefits and assistance from both the Democrats and the Republicans in the House and get it over to our good friends in the Senate so that as these not only former soldiers are in need, as the constituents of all of our districts are in need. And this bill, as many of you know, unemployment benefits, what we're doing is extending a helping hand out to try and get them up on their feet and moving back into society. I would very briefly and simply urge you to immediately amend or take whatever action is necessary on 3305 to ensure this is out to the floor as quickly as possible and therefore referred over to our brethren at the Senate. In closing, Mr. Chair, I would just leave for the record a copy of a letter I did send to the governor. I hope, besides the employment staff here testifying, I hope a representative of the governor's office here is to testify in support of this bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be happy to entertain questions.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you again for your testimony.
Thank you.
Could I have Steve Lanning and Bob Shiprack, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Steve Lanning. I'm with the Oregon AFL-CIO. The written testimony that's being handed out is from our president, Tim Nesbitt, who can't be here today and asked me to go on record for our organization. We represent 180,000 union members statewide and thousands more that are still unemployed. And as you pointed out, previous extensions, actually in the 2002 special session and then twice in the 03 session, this body, without a dissenting vote, extended unemployment insurance three times. And I think that that really speaks to the credit of both parties in this body. The one thing that we want to point out is that this bill isn't in conflict with a previous bill which passed this body, which actually lowers UI tax rates for employers, and this bill doesn't increase the UI tax rate for employers, so it's neutral as far as that goes, and we're supporting of it and ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob Shiprack, Executive Secretary, Oregon Building Trades Council. I want to thank Representative Nelson and the Speaker and the other folks on the committee for bringing this bill forward. I'm going to be very brief. I was asked to testify because this has been an issue that I've been trying to get pushed since some of those special sessions last year as well. Just on the way down here, Mr. Chairman, the March jobs report came out from the U.S. Department of Labor, and March was the worst job month in 8 months, so things are not very good, all due to increasing interest rates, I might add, from The Economist. I didn't talk to Representative Schaffler, but I want to take an opportunity to mention a program that I'm involved in. It's called Helmets to Hard Hats. It's a national program through all the international unions of the building trades and our employer associations. We have a website here in Oregon that the veterans and as well as the employment department are accessing for returning veterans. We've taken a number of these people in as either journeymen or apprentices, and I'm proud to say I've been told on a per capita basis we've recruited more returning veterans than any state in the nation and put into our programs and putting them to work in construction. I'll leave this with
thank you, John.
Thank you very much.
Is there any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, gentlemen. Could I have Tamara Rickman and Tom Byerly? Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tamara Rickman, and I have the Director of Unemployment Insurance here with me, Tom Byerly, so that he can explain how the program will work and answer questions with respect to the extension, should you have any questions.
Okay.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the Assistant Director for Unemployment Insurance for the Employment Department. Before I speak on House Bill 3305, I'd like to report that yesterday at the training for the returning National Guards people, I had two of my staff there providing information and claims filing information for those that are returning to no job and need to file a regular new unemployment insurance claim, and that went very well. It was very well received, and we're appreciative of that opportunity to work with those folks. This bill would provide 25% of a claimant's regular unemployment insurance claim. Normally, a regular unemployment insurance claim is 26 weeks, and 25% of that award would be 6.5 weeks. Why do we put 25% in the law? It's because there are times when there are claims the law provides for less than 26 weeks when their base year wages and their unemployment insurance claim calculation don't allow them to have 26 weeks. So those people would get 25% of whatever their maximum award would be. So, and there would be some cases where if we said 6.5 weeks in the law, there'd be individuals, albeit very few, that may end up getting more on the extension than they would have on their regular claim. So that's a technical reason we use 25%. We will pave these benefits for a period of 15 weeks, and we will start working on this as soon as it's passed. We'd like, obviously, as much time as we can to get it going, but we'll do whatever we can and break our necks to get it done.
Mr. Chair? Thank you. I want this out as fast as possible, too, but I don't expect miracles from people. I know we all want these benefits to get into these folks' hands as quickly as possible. Could you speak to the amendments putting it to May 1st and the logistic reasons for that?
The logistic reasons for that, originally when we spoke to Representative Nelson on the bill, we were talking early in March and provided for a week to maybe 10 days to get it through both chambers of the legislature. Mm-hmm. And that would give us 2.5-3 weeks to program our mainframe computer, get letters out to the applicants that may be eligible. What we do in these cases is we do a huge mass mailing off our computer of individuals that have had unemployment insurance claims. Many are back to work, many are not, but we want to make sure those that need to know about it get to know about it. So we are allowing for, again, a week to 10 days for passage and then 2.5 to 3 weeks to do the programming and get the letters mailed. So as we move through time and this bill hadn't been heard, the May 1 date was arrived at, thinking along the same lines. Week to 10 days for passage, that may be faster. 2.5 to 3 weeks to do the programming and get the procedure going.
Mr. Chair, if I might add, Chair Brown, Representative Schaffler, part of the reason why retroactivity is not allowed for in these bills is because that is an administratively extremely costly proposal to do retroactive benefits, because individuals have to call in on a weekly basis to prove that they've been available for work and actively seeking work, and to pay benefits for weeks that we haven't had that had those individuals provide proof for their eligibility would cause us to have to do a lot more intensive one-on-one qualifications for individuals to make sure that, yes, they were indeed in the state at this time period, and, yes, indeed, they weren't looking for work and available for work, that they didn't turn down any jobs, because that's the primary issue with respect to unemployment insurance is individuals have to maintain their eligibility every week for benefits.
Representative Holt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Barley, earlier, as was mentioned in previous testimony, you were before this committee, and we voted and passed out to lower the employer tax rate and reduce the trust funds by $200 million, and I expressed some concern about that. In your projections, are we going to be able to maintain that particular bill unchanged, that we're still going to keep that same tax rate proposed and reduce the unemployment trust funds by that much money?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, this bill in and of itself will not jeopardize those tax rates. I can't say if some other bill comes along that takes trust fund dollars what that may do in combination with this bill, but I want to be clear, this bill in and of itself will not jeopardize those rates.
Follow up, Chair. Thank you. Do you see other bills in conglomerate that may affect that tax rate then? Will that need to be addressed again?
Chair Brown, Representative Holvey, at this point we don't see any bills. It's early in the session still. I would hate to speculate.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Was there more testimony? We interrupted you. I know.
I want to be available for questions if there were any.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Senator Courtney, you honor us with your presence. Thank you.
Motley Crue, ain't we?
Chair Brown and members of the esteemed House Committee on Business, Labor, and All Consumer Affairs, I'm Peter Courtney, and I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem, and I'm a state senator. My district is number 11. That's portions of Salem, all of Jervis and Woodburn. I've come here today to support House Bill 3305. And I want to thank you for having a hearing on this measure. I also want to thank the good representative, Donna Nelson, for introducing it. I think this is a very important piece of legislation as we attempt to deal with the unemployment that exists in our great state of Oregon. And I will, I'll read briefly from a prepared text. My staff is rushing to have copies of my text presented because I think it's very proper that I leave with you written testimony as well as verbal testimony. The bill, as I understand it, and I have not carefully reviewed Representative Nelson's legislation, but if it's similar to the one that is going to be introduced on Monday in the Senate, we're talking about 6.5 weeks of additional time. Now, I do not know what this legislation says in particular, but the 7 was going to say from May 1, I think, to August 13, 14, to 15, and I don't know. I heard some questions here, and I'll defer to your expertise and your collective wisdom on that, but that was the period of time, at least in that legislation, and I do not know whether or not that has to happen in terms of the experts who just testified to you or not. I do know the number of workers involved was like 23,300, and that's a lot of that's a tremendous number of workers. I did that astounds me because I thought our economy was getting better, although I do not really believe that now and haven't for some time. And I do know that at least 40% of the people coming back from Iraq are unemployed. They do not have jobs, and which is rather alarming. That I did not know that those coming back from Iraq, that the number that do not have jobs is some 40%. And while 30% of them didn't have jobs before they went over, they sure didn't pick up jobs being over there. And that 10% of them, this is something that I think we're all going to have to work on, did have jobs, but their jobs have been taken away or reorganized away since they were over there. So 40% just on the veterans alone that are coming back. And I know you know that, but I found that rather alarming. Now, I understand we're talking $28 million here. Again, I'm not certified smart, esteemed members, that'll come from the fund, but by keeping it within $28 million, you do not have to increase the rates of the employer's employees. And I understand the average check will be $246.52. Now, you know, that's not a lot of money, but it is a lot of money when you're trying to get a job. Now, this thing ended in December 1 of last year, their benefits ended, and these individuals have been unemployed still since then. So it's really important that we do what we can to try to help them and their families. It also has an effect on the economy because that money gets into the economy. So this is a very powerful and good piece of legislation, and I'm here to support it, and I hope you'll consider it favorably and you'll use your collective wisdom on it. And if you need amendments, then I assume that you will do that in the appropriate way, because this is an extraordinary committee, a great chair. And this is the first House committee I have testified in front of this session. And depending on how you treat me, it may be at first and only the one, but I wanted to come here this morning. I was watching it on TV, and I said, got to go there. I just got to go there. It's my duty. So thank you very much, Chair Brown and members of the committee, for allowing me to come here at the last second and testify, and I appreciate very much your willingness to take up this very important issue to help all our Oregonians who are unemployed.
Thank you, Senator. Is there anything else I can do for you?
Well,
be careful.
No, you make me happy. Just let me be here.
I was out there last night when the National Guard guys were coming back, and one of the speakers did say that, and I can't remember sure which one, that there was that 50% of those people returning there were without jobs and would be looking for employment here very shortly. And I don't know where that figure came from, but I heard that mentioned out there last night.
Chair Brown, my figure came from, I don't know if you know him, Colonel Mike Caldwell of the National Guard. I think he's pretty well known in these chambers and a pretty good, reliable spokesperson. He gave me that 40% figure, 30% not having jobs, and they went over, coming back without them, and then 10% who did have jobs, and they've lost their jobs when they were over there because their companies or the public cities have reorganized or something like that. So that was the figures. That's my source, and those are the figures that were given to me. So
thank you, Senator. And there is an amendment that would adjust the date to May 1 in 6.5 weeks, so it sounds like the bills are virtually identical then.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on House Bill, which one is it? 3305. Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3305 and open a work session on House Bill 3305. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash ones into, would it be into the hand engrossed House Bill 3305?
No, just to the bill.
Then I would move the dash ones into House Bill 3305.
Representative Kitts moves the dash ones to House Bill 3305. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? None, that they're adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3305 as amended to the floor. Do we have to rescind the referral first?
Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move that we rescind the referral to Ways and Means on House Bill 3305.
Representative Kitts moves to rescind the referral to Ways and Means on House Bill 3305. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So done. And that should help expedite the movement of the bill. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3305 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 3305 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Everybody's talked out. Okay, thank you. Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Bar the door.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries. Representative Nelson will carry the bill on the floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for your check.
You earned every penny of it, Representative, so you shouldn't feel guilty.
Let's see, 2189, actually. I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 2189, and Janet...
bar the door.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2189 was heard by this committee at the end of January, and it specifies that final wages that are earned by an employee but paid to the employee's spouse or dependent child after the death of the employee, so this would be the employee's final check after that the employee earned but did not receive because of the death, that those wages are counted as wages in determining benefits under the public employee retirement system. Mr. Chair, there was no negative testimony. You did hear from the Department of Administrative Services, who requested the bill, and from the public employee retirement system on that bill. We also have an amendment to the bill that is adding a bill that you've also heard. That other bill was House Bill 2615, and it is now the dash one amendments. And that bill specifies that Oregon Health and Science University full-time teaching faculty accrue a year of retirement service credit under the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, the OPSERP, for each regular teaching year. It may have been an oversight that those people were not picked up, people that retired, that started working after August 29th, 2003. Other employees were picked up when that bill passed last session, but these employees were not. It affects very few employees, about 65, primarily their School of Nursing instructors at Oregon Health and Science University. So you have the two concepts unrelated into one bill. The reason for doing this was because of a relating clause issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And there's representatives from DAS about the first part of the bill and from the OHSU about the amendment, the dash one amendment.
Was there any testimony in opposition to either one of the bills?
No, Mr. Chair.
Does the person from DAS want to comment? Or from OHSU, one of the comments? Shake the head no. Okay. The chair would entertain a motion. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2189.
Representative Kitts moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2189. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, they are adopted. Representative Kitts.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2189 as amended to the floor. Do pass recommendation.
Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2189 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Katie, call the roll, please.
Representative Dillon.
Aye.
Representative Colby.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative
Stoller.
Aye.
Representative
Shields.
Aye.
Representative
Basketball.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. We need a carrier for this to explain it on the floor.
Janet.
Janet.
You don't think it'd go on the consent calendar?
Yeah. I'm
finished, Chair.
Representative Kitts.
I'd move to put it on the consent calendar.
It's on the... Representative Kitts moves House Bill 2189 be placed on the consent calendar. Any objection? Seeing none, it's done. Okay, and House Bill 2540 is, we pulled it from the schedule for today, so if there's anyone here to testify on it, it won't happen. Open a public hearing on House Bill 3206. Janet?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3206, at the request of the Associated General Contractors, Oregon Columbia Chapter, prohibits states or local public contracting agencies from awarding public contracts for public works or for personal service contracts to non-resident bidders that are education service districts. Mr. Chair, House Bill 279-120 defines a resident bidder for purposes of public contracting statutes as a bidder that's paid unemployment taxes or income taxes in the state during the previous year and has a business address in the state. So that's the definition of resident versus non-resident bidder. There's no nothing in current law that prevents going out of state to an ESD, and I understand that that has happened in the Vancouver area, from the Vancouver area, and that's what the bill is about, and there's representatives of AGC to testify. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Can I have Jessica Adamson, Jerry Milstead, and Ed Glad? We'll start with you, Jessica.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris-Adamson, and I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors in support of this bill. We've introduced this bill because we have had a problem with one out-of-state education service district who has taken it upon themselves to come into Oregon's market and compete against Oregon construction managers and contractors for public works contracts. We find it odd and a little bizarre that we need to bring this bill to you today, but it is disconcerting to us, first as taxpayers, that our taxpayer dollars are going to support an out-of-state public agency for construction services, but secondarily as a construction industry, disconcerting that we are put in a position of having to compete against an out-of-state public agency that doesn't have and doesn't have to count into their calculation the same kind of overhead that we do. So it is taking jobs away from Oregon workers. I have here today with me Jerry Milstead, who is the president of Milstead and Associates, who do this kind of work and have dealt with this issue, to talk about this issue from his perspective and the issues that he's dealt with. So go ahead and turn it over to Jerry.
Chair Brown, committee members, I thank you for the opportunity to testify today on behalf of this bill. As Jessica stated, there are two basic problems with, in our opinion, with these folks from especially Clark County. That's the group that's been competing in Oregon for management of construction projects and for school bond projects primarily. They were selected several years ago to manage a project at SIO. They responded to a request for proposal here last year with Jefferson County School District. They were not successful, but they did propose on that. and they were initially given an opportunity to work for Willamette ESD on a project with Sweet Home School District, and I think that response to that proposal is in front of you. They subsequently were not given the contract, but they were selected to do the project. And as Jessica said, the two problems we have is the fact that they are subsidized by the taxpayers of the state of Washington, and they do not have to pay for their lights and their office space and so forth. But if you look at the rates that they charge, that's in the Sweet Home proposal, they're comparable to the rates that the private sector, our competitors, and my firm charges to school districts. They are compatible with those rates. So that would indicate to me that the profits or what that they would glean from working with school districts in the state of Oregon would go to assist them in their costs in the state of Washington for their ESD. So those are the I'd say the two primary problems that we have with them: the fact that they're subsidized by the taxpayers of the state of Washington, and secondly that they take school bond money back to the state of Washington. And as you know, that's a very difficult thing for the school districts in this state to get bonds passed and add dollars to the taxpayers' property tax rolls. And unless you have questions for me.
Mr. Chair, if I may add a couple more items. First of all, they also have done work in Oregon. It's not that they just proposed. They've worked in the Silver Falls School District, and in the proposal you'll see at the very end it talks about projects of similar size and scope, and one of those is the Silver Falls School District, and they've worked elsewhere in the state. So they have been successful in acquiring some of these projects. I also want to note that this bill is very specific just to construction and construction services, and specified into ORS 279C, which is the construction only section of the public contracting statute. So this doesn't prohibit them from doing other kinds of services. It's just construction only, and that is the scope of the bill, and it only limits out-of-state education service districts, not all public agencies.
Go ahead, Ed, give your testimony.
My name is Ed Glad. I'm with Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. Just very briefly, we agree and are somewhat alarmed when education service districts are so far afield that they're interrupting construction management opportunities for private businesses to be able to participate in public works jobs. That alarm, obviously, at insult to injury, is when an out-of-state educational service district is so far afield from its own bailiwick there that they come into the state of Oregon and again disrupt the opportunity for private business to participate in public works. We certainly support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Shields.
Mr. Chair, I guess this might be for you. Is anyone from the ESD going to be testifying?
There isn't anybody signed up.
Well, I guess my question then is, are they using, I guess, special needs types of workers, people with disabilities, people who are in recovery or anything like that in these jobs?
The construction management operation has more to do with being, Chair Brown and Representative Shields. The construction management operation is to coordinate the various contractors that are going to come on to a particular work site. And in the state of Oregon, the one ESD that was actually doing this, Willamette ESD, and I think that they're finishing up a few jobs and they're decommissioning their actual program. But they were targeting or theoretically targeting smaller jobs, you know, things that wouldn't show up on the radar screen for construction or larger construction companies that would want to take this on. But obviously there is a marketplace of people that are strictly doing construction management for large and small jobs, and that is something that when the private sector has to compete against a publicly subsidized operation, it's very, very difficult for that to take place. So. It could be all sorts of different contractors.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, no, they are not.
Okay.
These are honest to goodness people that are not recovering or
necessarily.
Right.
Necessarily.
Right, and they're not hiring. They're not doing the hiring for these jobs. Right. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions? Representative Goldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this question is maybe for any of you or all of you. I apologize for maybe missing the front end of the testimony, but do we have similar problems with in-state ESDs and contracting agencies operating as general contractors or operating as construction managers? And do we have any data on whether they're really saving money for the contracting agency by so doing and displacing the private sector businesses?
Chair Brown, Representative Hooley, they certainly could say that they are saving money. There was the in-state ESDs. There's only one in-state ESD that we're aware of that has ventured into the construction business, construction industry, and that's Willamette ESD. But they have subsequently, to some complaints, they have pulled back, and they are completing some projects that they had previously contracted for, and have said that they're no longer going to pursue that venture. If you look at what the request for proposal response that Clark County ESD submitted to Sweet Home School District, you'll see that their rates and their actual percentage fee is equivalent to what the private sector firms in this state charge school districts. So I would say, based on that, the answer to your question is no, they don't save any money.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holby, we would say on the broader scale of do public agencies engage in construction under their own forces and construction management under their own forces, yes, we see that around the state in small pockets here and there. Do I have data on all of that? No, unfortunately I don't. But I think it is a concern of the construction industry, not only because it takes jobs away from the private sector, but because some of the work that's done, depending on the size and scope, there isn't the experience of folks that do maintenance. It's not the same as doing new construction or major renovation. The skill set is very different. And there is a concern on the part of the private sector, those of us who know the ins and outs of doing major renovation, doing major construction or new construction, that the taxpayers aren't getting the value that we bring to the project. The experience of doing this kind of work every day, of making sure that it's done right, for example, laying down a layer, doing patch hole, pothole work is very much one thing. Laying a new road or trying to do a major resurfacing project is very much another. And the kind of experience that it takes to do one doesn't give you the ability to do the other so well. And so we get very concerned when we see agencies move into that arena because we not only are frustrated that the private sector doesn't have the opportunity to provide that value, but we know that the experience and the quality of workmanship is not the same.
One other thing, as project managers, one thing, and especially working with school districts or public agencies in the state, we have to understand and the requirements of the public bidding laws, ORS 279, A, B, and C sections, in order to properly do our jobs. Those folks out of state certainly don't work with that every day. They're from a different there's different rules and different
public laws in the state of Washington, particularly. We work in the state of Washington as well, so it's an entirely different law in the state of Washington as here. I didn't bring it with me, but there are meeting minutes that I could supply the committee if you so choose, where we believe, this is an opinion of mine, that these folks have given actually bad advice to schools. One such incidence was they advised the school district that they could save them money if they, in fact, would not hire a general contractor, but serve as general contractor themselves and hire directly the trade contractors. And that's, to me, that is a that puts a school district or any owner in that case at great risk when you don't hire the general contractor and you take the trade contractors on yourself.
Representative Holy.
Follow-up with just a brief statement, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I brought that issue just because I was aware of a situation like exactly what you just described, where a school decided to operate as their own construction manager and hire out as a general contractor the specific trades, and being not as familiar as they should be with the laws, got into some problems, not just with the quality and using maintenance people to actually do the work, but also got into some problems with labor law as far as paying the right rates to individuals and policing it. And it was really concerning to me that in order for them to cut corners, that they, you know, were able to control the law basically because they're the only ones that really had great knowledge of it. So I'd really be interested in some sort of legislation that might curtail this practice. If you want to start working on it, I'd be fully supportive of it.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you, folks, for testifying today. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify on House Bill 3206? Good morning, Bob.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't intend to testify on this and hadn't really tracked the bill, but I'm Bob Shipback, Oregon Building Trades Council. I wanted to share just a story with you, another example of what this legislation, I hope, will stop. Last summer, I was asked by a floor covering contractor and one of my representatives of the floor covering industry to look at, I went over to their office, and what was going on is an ESD out of Seattle, Washington, was very successful in a series of school projects in supplying various floor covering, carpeting, linoleum, tile, things like that. Along with the supply of the materials, they also provided the workforce, all Washington residents. That's not bad. However, they were all independent contractors as well, so there was no taxes, no employer taxes. The wage rates were all wrong. Went over to see Craig Smith at the contractors board, and that was investigated. If the legislation goes forward, I'd be happy to find out the results of that investigation from Craig and supply it for the committee. But that's just another example of something. Oh, I should mention one other thing. Why the contractor got a hold of us. These were no bid contracts. No bid. Yep. Real.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Bob? Don't say any. Thanks. Thank you. Is there anyone else here for on House Bill 3206? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 3206. Pardon? Okay, Janet.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to point out that it does cover public works contracts as well as contracts for personal services, and that would include architectural engineering or land surveying services. And under construction, as Jessica mentioned, it does include major renovation. So,
okay. I would have liked to have heard from some of the public entities, but they didn't bother to show up. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3206. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I recommend that we send this to the House floor. Is that where it goes? Yeah,
yes.
Floor. With a due pass recommendation. 3206.
Representative Escobar moves House Bill 3206 to the House floor at the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Katie, call the roll, please.
Aye.
Excuse.
Aye.
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 Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair, would you like me to take this to the floor? You want to do it?
No, let's have someone carry it on the floor. Would you like to carry it?
Carry it.
Representative Escobar will carry it on the floor then. Now we're down to opening a public hearing on House Bill 2465. Janet?
Chair, House Bill 2465 was introduced by the Committee on Judiciary and increases county sheriff fees for serving of summons, subpoenas, or other legal documents from $28 to $38 and increases from $15 to $17 the fee per person if more than one person is served at a single address. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet.
They're down in the bus right now.
Can I have Laura Smith and Aaron Crow, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Laura Smith with Dave Barrows and Associates here today representing the Oregon Association of Process Servers. With me, I have the president of that association who's going to talk with you a little bit about the concept in the bill and a possible another concept that might get us to where we need to be.
Good morning, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Crow. I'm the president of the Oregon Association of Process Servers. I'm here to talk in favor of this bill. Last legislative session, the sheriffs attempted to raise the fees to $30. They were able to increase it to $28, representing a fee increase of $3, which is really a drop in the bucket of what is necessary to properly effectuate service. And since then, fuel prices have been rising at a dramatic rate, and there's no end in sight. Process servers need cars. I mean, we're not. And while I represent process servers through the Oregon Association of Process Servers, we're not bound by the sheriff's fee. We can essentially charge what we want as long as it's reasonable. In reality, however, we are tied to the fee. Virtually every attorney in Oregon sees the sheriff's fee as a benchmark in the industry. Now, this fee, we're really competing with that fee. That fee from an entity that charges a fee that is not tied to costs. Now, and the difference, of course, is paid by taxpayers. We would like to, there is a solution to, the fee increase really is necessary. The sheriff cannot serve it for $28. It is heavily subsidized. There's an alternative to coming before the legislature every year trying to cover some of the costs for fuel and other expenses, E&O insurance, errors and emissions, so forth. Now, private process servers have been serving papers in the state for almost 60 years. We're certain that we provide a superior service to the sheriff. Now, even in California, where the fee has been $30 since 2001, a number of counties, the sheriff has essentially stopped doing process altogether because they couldn't afford it. We're talking about Alameda County, San Mateo County, Santa Clara County, Contra Costa County, Lassen County to the north, El Dorado County to the north, Riverside County to the south. We're talking a lot of counties just getting out of the business because what they're charging to perform these services have nothing to do with the costs. It's a big subsidy. We would like to see the costs, the people who use the service bear the costs, which are still reasonable, even at $38 to perform the fees and what we do. What I am suggesting as an alternative to this is essentially where the process server is an option to the sheriff. In counties, for instance, that have a population over 100,000, where there are plenty of private process servers in existence, to let the free market do its thing to control the costs and remove the sheriff in those areas where a private process server is available as an alternative in those counties with a population over 100,000. That would include the Tri-County area and a couple of counties down the I-5 corridor. It has worked very successfully in California. Very successfully. And I'm available for any questions you might have on this.
Any questions? Thank you. Jim Markey and John Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Jim Markey representing the Oregon Collectors Association, and I appear today in opposition of House Bill 2465. I've represented the Oregon Collectors Association for 28 years, and this issue has been around every one of those 28 years. What is the amount that should be in the statute? And we've made a lot of changes over the years as to who could serve papers, how they could be served, and what could be charged. And several sessions ago, prior to several sessions ago, these fees were absolutely statutory, and sheriffs and private process servers could charge no more or no less of what the statutory fee was in all cases. And we made a lot of changes which eventually took the private process servers out from under any requirement to charge anything in the statute, so ultimately they can charge whatever they want. We continue to set the maximum amount to be charged by a sheriff in the statute. And the reasoning of the legislature in doing that was that you want to try to keep the sheriff's fee somewhere close to the market so that if there is no private process server available, or if a private process server tried to gouge somebody by charging too much and they were the only game in town, that there would always be the alternative of going to the sheriff and have the paper served for a reasonable fee. The legislature also put in a provision in previous sessions, and if it's actually this present law appears on page 2, lines 1 and 2, that says amounts paid for service of process or other documents may be recovered as costs and disbursements to the extent provided in ORS 20.115. And that statute limits recovery of service fees by a plaintiff to the amount that would have been charged by the sheriff. So in other words, if I have the sheriff or somebody else serve the paper and I pay him $28, which is allowed by law, I'm allowed to recover that as costs if I win the case, if I sue him and win the case. I get that $28 back from the defendant. And, of course, with our clients, these are people who owe money, debtors. If I pay a private process server more than the $28, which I'm allowed to do now if I paid him $50 to serve the paper, I'm still only allowed to recover $28 from the debtor. And that's there as a safeguard so that we don't get some kind of sweetheart deal between a process server and a debt collector or somebody else where they're paying in excess of market. So this system works pretty good, and we don't see where there's a huge need to raise the sheriff's fee as high as $38, certainly. The fee was $25 until last session, and the sheriffs felt that they would like to have an increase, and I worked with John Powell here as the representative of the Sheriff's Association, as we have done in past sessions, and we worked out a 10% increase, and took a little over 10% increase, took the fee from $25 to $28. And that's how we've done it in the past, and I understand that the private process servers would like to see the sheriff's fee above market because then they could charge more, and certainly that's, I mean, and not have somebody out there that was charging less, but I don't think that's the spirit of what was intended in the statute, and I don't think it's called for. And again, I want to emphasize that private process servers can charge anything they want. They are not prohibited from charging whatever they want. So with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Thanks. Appreciate it, Jim. John.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Mr. Chairman, I've been asked by the Civil Managers Legislative Group of the Sheriff's Association to oppose House Bill 2465 in its current form. As Mr. Marquis has pointed out, there's a delicate balance between where this fee is set and how the system operates. Also, speaking to the alternative that was mentioned, sheriffs are called in to serve papers many times in all these various areas when there is hostility or conflict at issue. And so it could be domestic, it could be a landlord-tenant, it could be a whole series of things. So I don't think it would be wise to in any way eliminate the sheriff from the service areas that was indicated earlier. It is a delicate balance, and we would prefer a process where we could work with all the parties and come back with something. We did not expect this issue to come forward this session. As Mr. Marquis pointed out, we did reach a compromise last session, so we had not done any work, and our first notice of this was when the bill was printed. So we're opposed to the bill, and would answer any questions.
Any questions? Yes, Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have one question. I'm just curious if the Sheriff's Association has any figures about the actual cost of serving, the average cost of serving a paper to the Sheriff's Department.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hovely, I'll have to see if I can get back to you. I think it would vary by county to a certain extent based on geography and other...
Yeah, I was kind of looking for an average.
Yeah, I'll try to get that for you.
Thank you.
Representative Holvey, I know in Jackson County I've discussed this with our Sheriff Mike Winters about serving papers, and it's in the county charter. So, you know, the cost to me in that particular scenario really doesn't matter, because that's the job of the sheriff right in the county charter. So it's in stone there, unless they go out and change that. So.
And Mr. Chair and Representative Hovey, if I could comment on your question. $28 fee is not a universal fee that is charged by everyone. And I don't know exactly what the cost is, and I agree with John here that that's going to vary from county to county and from service to service. The $28 is the base fee, and if you read the rest of the statute, there are additional things that can be added to that by the sheriff, mileage if it's in excess of 75 miles, etc. But I do want to point out that in the more populous areas, like Salem, for instance. My client, Cascade Collections, here in Salem, who happens to be my legislative chair and couldn't be here today, but he has an agreement with a private process server here, and he pays $25 a paper. So that's $3 under what's allowed now. So, and I don't think that's unusual. I think there are people out. Obviously, he's a high volume. I mean, higher volume user than somebody who would wander in and just have one paper a year. But in many instances, I believe that people are paying less than the $28 to private process servers, and that's good because these as I pointed out earlier, these fees get passed on to debtors. So they're the ones that ultimately pay the bill.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You. Anyone else would like to speak to this issue? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on this. Business?
8:30 on Monday.
8:30 Monday. We get to hit it again. Rock and roll. See you Monday, 8:30. Have a good weekend. We'll adjourn. Thank you.